Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show, hosted by author, investor, money partner, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, my name is Bruce Norris, and I welcome you to our show. Very excited today to get to interview Paul Leonard. He's the director of the California Office for the Center of Responsible Lending. Paul, welcome to our show.
Great to be here.
Probably the hottest search in real estate on the web in the last couple of years has been the subject of the real estate bubble. In the last 90 days, it's probably shifted to subprime lending bites the dust. What happened? What caused that transition?
Well, I think that what has happened has really been changes in the marketplace over the last 60 to 180 days, where we began to see a substantial slowing in housing price appreciation, and which brought to the fore the fundamental weakness in the underwriting of a lot of the subprime mortgages that were being made, leading to a spike in defaults and to a heightened understanding of the risk of foreclosures that are likely going to follow from, again, what has been some really fundamentally flawed underwriting of the subprime mortgages.
In the report that the Center of Responsible Lending wrote in December 06 called Losing Ground, one of the key points of it for me was that they were talking about that in inflationary times, you have a substitute for foreclosures by a forced payment, they called it, to where you had people really having an exit for the problems that they got into.
Right.
And it, at the end of this one part of the report, it says, in other words, strong housing appreciation may protect a market from high foreclosures, but not from failed loans. Now that the strong appreciation is gone, what are we expecting to see in the next couple of years?
Well, our report projected that, first of all, it found that foreclosure rates, even with a strong housing market, that the foreclosure rates in the subprime market were much higher than have been tolerated in normal prime markets. Even during the strong years of the early 2000s, completed foreclosure rates ranged from 9%, 10%, 12%. And with the current forecasted decline in appreciation rates and observed decline in appreciation rates, we are projecting that up to 1 in 5 subprime loans made nationwide, as well as slightly higher ranges here in California, would end in foreclosure.
Would that percentage be an all-time high for any segment of loans ever written?
Yes, it would. The levels of foreclosures that are projected are higher than the foreclosures that were experienced in Southern California when the defense industry basically shut down. It would be higher than in the oil patch states where you had a deep recession in the real estate markets there. This would be the highest recorded foreclosure rates that we have ever seen in any segment of the market.
You used a term that's rarely used, and I really respect it. You said something about the inevitable outcome. I interviewed a number of people that are collectors of foreclosure data, and the comment is that we're returning to a more normal level of foreclosures. And I contest that because, to me, it's the direction that's important. Do you see any way that the direction of foreclosures going up will be reversed anytime soon?
Not anytime soon. I mean, one can never fully project the direction of housing prices and real estate markets. But I think that the signs from the subprime market suggest that there's still a long ways to go. Where we have seen a dramatic shift in the subprime market, literally in the last 2 weeks, where a number of major players in the marketplace have gone out of business or have seen the Wall Street's faith in their performance really ebbing. Those signals are driven by early payment defaults, where borrowers are defaulting on loans within the first often within the first month or two of those loans being made, but in all cases being made within the first 6 months of those loans. What we haven't yet seen is the playing out of people who are in adjustable rate mortgages, where those adjustment rates are the adjustment dates aren't going to happen beyond that first few months of the loans.
Correct. If the percentage is correct, the 20 or 24% foreclosure rate, and that's not delinquency rate. We're talking about foreclosures in the sense that these are going to end up in the lender's hands or at the courthouse steps. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Those are completed foreclosures that are what we have projected.
Okay. If that takes place, I would say that the market would definitely have some other reactions. Would you expect there would be a lot more lender failures coming?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the pace of lender failures has been really staggering, with some of the leading players in the subprime mortgage market really biting the dust. Just in the last week, we have the Fremont, as one of the top 10 lenders, has been shut down its subprime lending activities. New Century is now under criminal investigation and is clearly in a position that is reeling. And a number of other large players in the subprime market, Resme, Own It, American Home Loan Network, have all literally gone out of business within the last few months.
When these lenders go out of business, it seems to me there's going to be a fair amount of people out of work. So we're looking at probably an increase in unemployment, and does that sometimes lead to migration movement of people to where maybe they'll be moving out of that area to another location?
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons that our organization came to California is the concentration of the subprime lenders in Southern California, particularly in Orange County. And we have already begun to see some reports of the employment impacts and the concentrated employment impacts there in Orange County. There clearly will be some sort of movement that is associated with that, and some rippling economic effects that are at least somewhat locally concentrated in Southern California.
We've had low down payment programs before. So what's different this time? What makes a subprime loan a more dangerous product?
Well, the product that has become the standard in the subprime industry. First of all, I think it comes from a combination of the layering of different risky features.
Okay.
Part of it is low down payments. Part of it is an increasing reliance on stated rather than verified income, and probably most importantly is the fundamental product that's being offered in most cases in the subprime market. It's called a 2/28 mortgage.
Correct.
Where the initial payment is fixed for a period of 2 years at a discounted teaser rate, and then there is an adjustment that happens, which is going to be a significant payment shock at month 25. And what that in effect means is that people really are being, and the underwriting for these loans is very aggressive, so that people are being underwritten paying up to 50% debt to income ratios to meet their initial discounted payment. The fundamental structure means that people aren't going to be expected to be able to meet their payment in month 25 when the adjustment actually occurs, forcing either a refinance or, when the housing market has slowed down as it has now, often default and foreclosure.
Now, you mentioned that most of these loans have a prepayment penalty. Sometimes they last maybe 24 months. So the problem could probably be worse. Let's say a 2005 subprime loan really doesn't have that problem until 2007, and 2006's batch won't have the problem of resetting a payment until 2008.
So, exactly.
So we're really in for a tough couple of years.
It is likely to be at least a few years. I mean, one of the things that we saw in 2003, 2004, 2005 was that people were refinancing their loans well before they got to the two-year mark. And part of that is that people were taking out equity. A part of that, we believe, comes from the fact that most subprime loans, unlike prime loans, don't have an impoundment or an escrow account set up for people to pay their taxes and insurance bills on an ongoing basis. So one of the factors that contributes to the need to refinance is that they get hit with, they're already paying 50% of their income to make their initial payment, and then they get a big insurance bill or tax bill. And so they can use the equity appreciation that they've had to be able to pay off that unexpected large balance of tax or insurance bills that come in.
So if the person ultimately hits 2007 and 8 and decides, okay, I no longer have equity, I no longer can make the payment, and they haven't been making their property tax payments, then the lender gets to hold the bag of the late taxes as well?
I believe that's correct, yes.
Yeah, that is true. Okay. Were brokers rewarded in some way by steering people to these subprime loans?
Absolutely. There's a big problem in the housing marketplace today, where the incentive systems that brokers have are not aligned with the interests of consumers. Consumers have the interest of getting the lowest cost loan that they can afford to repay over the life of the loan. The brokers have incentives that reward them for bringing in loans at higher interest rates, called yield spread premiums. And what in effect those are is if they bring in their loans at an interest rate higher than the par rate for which a borrower could qualify, they will get a kickback from the lender for bringing in these higher interest rate loans.
Was that kickback disclosed on paperwork?
It is often, in most cases, the payment to the broker is initially disclosed, but the kickback is not generally disclosed in the formal paperwork that is processed.
Okay, so the borrower probably is looking at a broker getting maybe a point or something like that.
And that's correct.
And then in the back end, there could be 3 or 4 points.
There could be additional points that can go anywhere up to 2, 3, 4 points. Not unusual.
Okay.
And one of the other interactions there is that as the there will be an increase in the payment for a broker for bringing in a loan at a higher rate, there will also be some incentives provided to the broker for including the prepayment penalty. So the brokers have an incentives to offer up loans that are to maximize their returns. They're working directly counter to the interests of the borrowers.
These incentives that are built into the loans, does that make it easier for them to be sold to Wall Street? Is that the intent? Is let's do the loan that Wall Street wants to buy?
Absolutely. I mean, the demand from Wall Street is to bring in the higher rate loans,
mm-hmm.
And whatever it takes to get those. And so there are a number of features that are provided some rewards, including a stated income loan. You know, most borrowers, for many borrowers, it wouldn't be a hard thing to do to pull together the documentation that they need in order to avoid an interest rate premium. But in many cases, borrowers aren't really familiar with the way the loans work. The loan is presented as, we'll just do a stated income loan, it will be done quickly, and it will come in there will be an interest rate premium added onto that simply because it's a stated income loan.
A lot of times that interest rate premium isn't felt until month 25 is what you're saying, because they have a teaser rate payment that seems very manageable, but they don't realize that the premium is going to hit 25 months later.
Well, no. In some cases, in many cases, the initial rate is higher than it needs to be.
Okay, so the...
I think that you have a mortgage marketplace where you have a huge imbalance in the information between most borrowers and the mortgage professionals who they're dealing with.
Okay.
I think most people look at mortgage brokers really as their sort of financial advisors, particularly people who are not savvy and experienced and who have credit problems. they're going to a mortgage professional expecting that the mortgage broker is really working in their own financial best interest.
So there's an expectation that there is a fiduciary relationship when really none exists?
Well, there is under common law, there is an established fiduciary relationship in California for brokers.
Okay.
But the brokers also have a duty to the lenders as well. And so at a minimum, there's a conflict of interest where the brokers are answering both to the borrowers as well as to the lenders, which really suggests a conflict of interest that at the end of the day, if the financial incentives are in place to reward brokers for bringing in higher rate loans, that's the direction in which most end up doing.
Okay. The prices in California pretty much tripled since 97.
Yes.
And has it been common for people to retain that equity and make their life more comfortable as far as monthly situation, or has it been our tendency to refi that out, and have they often used subprime loans to do that?
Well, I think that, I think it's been pretty clear that a lot of equity has been refinanced. As I said earlier, last year we took a look at a number of securities and found that the proportion of borrowers who had, of the loans in those securities that had refied out, there were roughly 75% of the loans were gone by 18 months. So there is clearly a lot of there has been until now, when as prices appreciated, I think a lot of folks are pulling out equity in order to enhance their current quality of life.
And that is despite the fact that they had a prepayment penalty?
Yes.
They ate
absolutely.
That anyway. Wow.
Absolutely.
That eats up a lot of equity.
it does eat up a lot of equity. And again, I think the idea that, again, there's a lot of not full understanding. The prepayment penalty can get refinanced into the back end of the loan so that people don't actually feel it so much.
Right.
And, the desire to pull out equity trumped the hard financial calculations of what it was actually going to cost.
Absolutely. Well, recently we've had a lot of developments that probably make the Wall Street people that are buying these notes a little skittish. What happens when Wall Street buys a pool of loans and there's a fair amount of defaults early on? What is their recourse? And what is their recourse if the lender is no longer there?
Well, the initial warranties and representations of these loans allow the investors or require that the original lenders will buy back the loans if there are early payment defaults, if there are certain levels of early payment defaults. And that's what's triggered a lot of the collapse of a number of companies that that there has been a steep increase just in the last 6 to 12 months in the number of early payment defaults, more than the lenders were certainly projecting. Lenders were being asked to come up with capital to buy back those loans, which in some cases they didn't have adequate capital reserves, and that's when the lenders will go out of business.
When the lenders go out of business, where does Wall Street turn to? Do they just literally have to foreclose on the properties and take whatever hit they're going to take?
Well, again, these are early payment defaults short of foreclosures, and it's an area of the law and the securitization process that I'm not all that familiar with. But
okay.
my sense is they're not going to have any recourse at that point. They're going to have to keep the securities and work with the servicers to see if they can mitigate their losses.
Around December 05, there was something I read about a 42-page, not a report, but it was a new loan guidance suggestion. And basically now some of that seems to be more the standard. What changes does the Center of Responsible Lending recommend to fix what's broke in the loan business?
Well, there are a few standards, and the short version is we're really suggesting a return to sort of sound responsible underwriting that is what the sort of basis of mortgage lending has been for most of the last 50 to 100 years, that we expect that the lenders will apply an ability to pay test to the borrowers over the life of the loan and not just for the initial payment. That's first and foremost the most important feature, and that's been the hallmark of the guidance that was put out by federal bank regulators last fall. And just last week, the federal bank regulators included these hybrid arms, these 228 and 327 adjustable rate mortgages, which have these large payment shocks. They've established a new standard which says you have to qualify borrowers for those loans based on the fully indexed interest rate, not just the discounted initial teaser rate.
That probably will eliminate a lot of buyers in California, that's for sure.
Well, it may very well eliminate a lot of borrowers, however, buyers. But one of the sort of little known facts, and I think it's a really important one, is that most of those buyers could get qualified for a standard 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, paying an interest rate spread of only somewhere between 50 to 80 basis points higher.
Okay.
That is, they could eliminate all of the risk associated with adjustable rates if they could afford to pay an interest rate that was between a half and 1 percentage point higher. They could eliminate all the questions about how much their rates were going to adjust in the future.
Would that loan program also allow them to just simply state what they make?
The regulators have said have begun to establish some new standards or suggested standards for stated income loans.
Okay.
In general, the regulators seem to be saying, first of all, to discourage stated income loans, particularly from standard W-2 wage earner folks, that if you have an easily verifiable income, they are urging the lenders to revert back and use a standard of verifying income, using tax returns, pay stubs, or other readily available information. They have not prohibited that in any way. However, last week, Freddie Mac also came out with a statement, and they said they are no longer going to buy loans unless they are underwritten based on the fully indexed rate, and they too are going to substantially tighten up on the purchase of loans that don't include verified income for standard wage earners.
We've only got about a minute left today. Let me just ask one last question. Do you foresee the FHA loan making a big comeback?
I think that's a possibility. FHA reform has been proposed for the last couple of years, including the adoption of risk-based pricing. There may very well be a role for FHA to play. It has certainly lost a huge amount of market share as these other subprime risk-based pricing entities have gained market share. But the demise of much of the subprime lending infrastructure suggests that maybe FHA has a new role to play.
Especially if I think it's H.R. 3043, it would allow FHA to have zero down and bring up the loan limits to the enterprise loan limit. So that, mm-hmm. that would create a lot of liquidity.
Yes. That's again, I think I don't think we've all yet fully absorbed what the impact of the sharp decline, the tightening of underwriting standards from both Wall Street as well as from lenders is going to be in the subprime market yet.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for our interviewing you today. We're going to join you in the next show as well to continue this discussion.
I look forward to it.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com or email questions and or comments to radio@thenorrisgroup.com. We'll see you next week at 5:30 here on News Talk 590 KTIE.